Hello, and welcome to another edition of the AskQuestions.org podcast. First up, LQ updates. The first update I have is that LQ is going to be a sponsor of the upcoming IT360 Canada. IT360 is an enterprise network full circle, and it's in Canada. It's an IT conference and expo for IT professionals responsible for enterprise networks and is dedicated to all aspects of the network. And here's a little promotional blurb from them. In the climate of ever-accelerating change, technologies continue to interconnect, creating the need for more elaborate, company-specific solutions. IT360 has evolved with this technology phenomenon. Information technology is fundamental in today's business environment. Computers and computing devices are integral to everyday communication. And this is going to take place from April 30th to May 2nd at the Metro Toronto Convention Center, and that's in the North Building. This is what used to be Linux World Canada. Just this year, basically, Linux World Canada and Network World Canada, and I believe one other conference merged into this, so it's going to be, should be a pretty interesting conference. I am almost certainly going to attend, and if you want to check out more on the IT360, it's IT360.ca. The next LQ update I have is that the LQ Radio interview series has returned. And I'm really happy to announce that the LQ Radio interview series has finally returned. This has been a little while coming now. I'd like to thank both Elon and Orv of Scale. Elon is the conference chair and Orv is the PR chair. And they were the last guests on the show. I posted this about a week or two ago. Now, we covered a good amount of different topics and I tried to keep it to about 30 minutes and it's right in that range. We used Gizmo this time. The previous LQ Radio interview series had been using Skype. I think overall the quality of this was considerably better, and the size on the both MP3 and AUG are considerably smaller, so we've learned a little bit since we did the last ones. We do have a few minor tweaks to make for future interviews, but nothing major. And we should have more interviews on the way soon. We have a couple great guests lined up, and this is something that should be fairly regular now. Now, on to the news. The first story I have is Microsoft urges review of Google DoubleClick deal. And it's really amazing how quickly things can change sometimes. Microsoft, who's really the consummate antitrust defendee, is now asking for help from antitrust authorities. And this is from a New York Times article. Quote, Microsoft, a veteran defendant of epic antitrust battles with the United States and Europe, is urging regulators to consider scuttling Google's plan to buy DoubleClick, an online advertising company. Microsoft contends that the $3.1 billion deal, announced on Friday, would hurt competition in the fast-growing market for advertising on the web and raises questions about how personal information would be collected by Google, already a dominant player in online advertising. Bradford L. Smith, Microsoft's general counsel, said in an interview yesterday that Google's purchase of DoubleClick would combine the two largest online advertising distributors and thus substantially reduce competition in the advertising market on the web. Google dismissed Microsoft's assertions. We've studied this closely, and their claims, as stated, are not true, Eric Schmidt, the chief executive of Google, said in an interview last night. End quote. Now, I'd guess this is just ironic to a whole slew of people. Microsoft clearly had a different take on, you know, quote-unquote, substantially reduced competition when they were on the other side of the equation, and they typically are on the other side of this particular equation. And I think this might mark another watershed moment for Microsoft. They may have hit the realization that they're unable to effectively compete in a certain market, and this one being online advertising. They've thrown money at it, they've thrown resources at it multiple times, they've stated that they're going to step up in this area, both search and advertising online, and really with little result on either end. The fact that, of all companies, they're so quickly asking for this is really indicative of their current situation. It's even more ironic to me, considering that any deal this big, when you're talking about one multi-billion dollar advertising media company purchasing another one for $3.1 billion, there surely would have been a thorough review of this anyway. So Microsoft doing this really just shows how weak their position is, with little upside, at least from my point of view. One thing is definitely clear here, though, is Microsoft is no longer the bulldozing behemoth that they once were. You know, they once had the position that if they were coming into a market, a lot of people just wanted to leave it, and that's absolutely no longer the case, not by a long shot. The next story I have is Thinking Past Platforms, the Next Challenge for Linux. And this is from Doc Searles, who recently posted his last suit watch. And it'll be sad not to see the email every other Wednesday. And for those of you who haven't subscribed to Suit Watch, you can check out the archives online. It's definitely worth the read. But the reasoning that Doc gave definitely does make sense. The form and flow of a text email newsletter really wasn't congruent with Doc's strengths. And it is good to hear that by him not doing Suit Watch, we're actually going to see even more of his writing. It'll just be on the Linux Journal site now. So overall, I think net, that's definitely a win. So moving on to the actual content of that last suit watch, the following really struck me. Quote, "That's the gauntlet I want to throw down on this, my last suit watch. I want to challenge the big hardware OEMs, Dell, HP, Lenovo, Sony, and the rest of them, to break free of the only form factors Microsoft will let them make and start leading the marketplace. Make cool, interesting, fun, and useful stuff that isn't limited by the Microsoft's catalog of possibilities. Stop making generic stuff. Grow greener grass beyond the Windows fences." A few weeks ago, I was talking with folks who worked inside one of the large hardware OEMs. Somewhere in there, they told me about their quote-unquote Linux strategy. I told them they needed a Linux strategy about as much as a construction company needed a lumber strategy. If you're going to have a Linux strategy, make the strategy about getting past the OS-bound view of the world. Because the big difference between Linux and Windows is that you can build anything you want with Linux. With Windows, you can only build what Microsoft lets you build. Think about it. Does Microsoft tell HP how to make printers? Does it tell Sony how to make camcorders or flat displays? Hell no. Then why do these companies let Microsoft tell them how to make desktops and laptops? Another way of putting it, why should the choice of personal computing hardware form factors be limited by the thing Windows can do? Why wait for Microsoft to provide the base design for desktops, laptops, notebooks, and handhelds? Why not let your engineers' imaginations run wild? Why not listen to customers who want personal computers that do stuff Windows can't, or Apple OS X, for that matter, can't do? The short answer is politics. All technical problems are political as well as technical, Craig Burton once told me. And the technical problems can always be solved. The politics of OS choosing is the politics of marriage. The big hardware OEMs have been acting for decades like they're married to Microsoft, which is why their act as if putting Linux on boxes with Microsoft logos tattooed on their butts is like cheating on their spouse. End quote. And this is something I said on the podcast and even on my blog previously. I think OEM adoption is really a critical step in Linux crossing that next chasm, and I've probably said that too many times to even remember now. Now, looking back a couple years, I'd have thought someone would have broken ranks by now, to be honest, but the politics are proving to be quite strong here. Now, if I would have had to guess back then, I would have thought that the catalyst would be Apple, actually. My thinking there is that what Apple's been able to do with hardware would give other hardware vendors a glimpse of what could be accomplished with a Unix-based system. But that just wasn't enough, I guess. Now, whether huge numbers of Dell customers yelling loudly on the IdeaStorm site is enough remains to be seen. They have tacitly said they're going to have some Linux somewhere, but what we need is a real Linux is an option on every model. It's just a checkbox or drop-down. Do you want Windows, Linux? You know, what would you like? Not these seven models, you can have Linux, kind of, but it's more expensive or you can't get certain features, which is what Dell has kind of historically done. But having a hardware OEM look at Linux as the building blocks to innovation is a great analogy. The first one who will get that, though, remains to be seen. The next story I have is GPL v3. Linux and GPL v2 compatibility. And this is from Allison, who continues her good coverage of the whole GPL v3 process going at the O'Reilly Radar. And this is from one of her latest posts. Quote, "A third possibility is that the Linux kernel developers will decide that it's not worth the hassle and just accept the GPL version 3. I suspect that this is what the Free Software Foundation is hoping will happen. Depending on the changes in the next two drafts of the GPL version 3, it still might, but it's not looking likely that the kernel developers will yield. Frankly, if I were in the kernel developer's shoes, I wouldn't either. The GPL v3 serves to further the goals of the FSF, but the current draft actually hinders Linus's goals and the goals of Linux in general. Another possibility, complete speculation on my part, is that the Linux Foundation becomes more than just a loose consortium of companies sponsoring Linux kernel development. It becomes the copyright holder for the Linux kernel, not taking copyright assignments from contributors like the FSF, but copyright licenses like Apache does, so the kernel developers still hold the copyrights on the code. The Linux Foundation releases a license with basically the same terms as the GPL version 2, but without the legal ambiguities, obscure language, and anachronisms. Like the GPL, this license is copyleft. Like the GPL, this license requires the release of modified versions under the same license. This license clearly defines the concept of linking and modified works, makes it easier for Linux distributors to be sure that their segmented distribution trees are in compliance. Over time, more and more projects currently released under the GPL adopt this Linux license because it is more legally precise and more comprehensible to the average developer than either the GPL version 2 or the GPL version 3. Eventually, Linux distributions switch over to the Linux license, leaving only a small branch of GPL v3 or v5, v4, whatever code to be downloaded separately if the user chooses to do so. End quote. Now, to be honest, it had occurred to me that it might make sense or be kind of nice if the Free Software Foundation did a sort of updated draft of the GPL version 2 that included some very minor improvements while not introducing any of the major fundamental shifts that the GPL version 3 has done. Now, at this point, it's clear they wouldn't actually do that, as it would really hinder adoption of the GPL version 2. Any way they could strengthen GPL version 2 at this point would hinder, obviously, the adoption of GPL version 3. What I hadn't thought of was the possibility of someone else improving on the GPL version 2. Now, it seems unlikely, be it Linux Foundation or otherwise, but maybe just the thought of this happening will smooth some things over in the GPL version 3 process and kind of give the FSF a little more of a motivation to make sure that that is a smooth process. The next story I have is Note to Content Owners, DRM Doesn't Work. And this is from a recent post from Mark Shuttleworth over on his blog about some of the kind of follies of DRM. I've said in the past that I think it's possible for DRM to have a place, but when it gets in the way of the consumer, it's just downright stupid. And let me say that most implementations now are pretty stupid. When people can't legitimately pay you for something and they want it, they will just route around you. And as a Linux user, there's a lot of things I'd like to pay for, but either can't or it's really, really hard. Most people are honest and they do want to pay. So punishing them for the mistakes of a vast minority who will never pay anyways is really just silly. And here's a quote from that article by Mark. Quote, "The truth is also that, as the landscape changes, different business models come and go in their viability. These folks who try to impose analog rules on digital content will find themselves on the wrong side of the tidal wave. Sorry for you. It's necessary to innovate, again sometimes, and stay ahead of the curve, perhaps even be willing to cannibalize your own existing business, though, to be honest, cannibalizing someone else's is always much more appealing. Someone will find a business model that doesn't depend on the old way of thinking, and if it's not you, then they will eat you alive. You'll probably sue them, but this will be nothing but a defensive action as the industry reforms around the new business model without you. And by the industry, I don't mean your competitors. They will likely be in the same hole, but your suppliers and your customers. The distributors of content are the ones at risk here, not the creators or the consumers." End quote. And in my opinion, he's 100% right here. We're reaching the point where the average person is sick of the current situation. You have the RIAA suing people, including kids. I think in one case, someone without a computer. Formats that only work on some devices and not others, or you can't transfer between devices. And just really a myriad of arbitrary technical limitations that aggravate and confuse the average consumer, and even aggravate the more technical consumer. So someone here will make it easy. Someone will come up with a new business model, and that someone will make an absolute boatload of money, and people will love them for it. I think the revolution will be televised. I just don't think it's going to be wrapped in DRM. The last story I have is open source and business. Now, in dealing with open source and kind of the business world as opposed to more the community side of it, it's amazing how often I run into statements like, you know, we don't use open source because we need a supported product, or isn't all open source no cost, or yeah, but you can't make money with open source, things of that nature. Now, I think some of this misinformation is simply the fact that open source is a somewhat new way of doing things, and old habits die hard, and that's true in software, it's pretty much true in everything, it's part of human nature. Another part of it, of course, is the FUD spread by some that are straining to maintain that status quo and really raging against the machine and doing anything they can to maintain it. I won't touch on that part today, though, because I touch on that all the time. The fact is, commercial open source companies have to offer quality support. It's where a lot of them provide their value, and therefore where they make the lion's share of their money. You see, they're not selling you boxed bits, so they have to provide that additional value. Now, I think it's clear to most that all open source doesn't come at no cost. That's one that I think we're finally starting to get over, but it is a fairly common misconception. There's so many examples of this that I need not go through them now, but I think this is one that we have probably the best chance of changing the perception on in the near future. Now, as for the last one, there's a ton of companies making money with open source. In some cases, lots of money. The fact that being open can be extremely good for business is actually what sparked kind of this topic for me, and this is from a recent post by Jonathan Schwartz on his blog. And for those of you unfamiliar with Jonathan, he's the CEO of Sun. Quote, "For years we were called proprietary, a moniker that did more damage to Sun than any market downturn. And frankly, we spent years recovering. But at this point, my hope is that we've completely turned that slur on its head, that we have come to define open. More open than any other vendor, more open than open itself, from silicon to systems, software to storage, and services. And this is where open translates to open to opportunity." End quote. So you may ask, how is the Sun stock doing since this transition started? So in the last 2 years, which is roughly I think when this started, the stock has almost doubled. The general consensus about Sun has gone from one really of near death to one of rejuvenated innovation. Open source isn't only good for the consumer, although it is. It's good for the whole chain. It's just taking some longer than others to figure that out. That's all I have for now, but thanks for listening.